In our studies of the heroes and heroines of the faith in Hebrews chapter 11, we turn this evening to look at the faith of King David. And just to think of David as a hero of the faith raises all sorts of moral and spiritual problems. The Bible tells us that David was a man after God's own heart, and that is the description of David in the eyes of God, a man after God's own heart, which simply means that David was God's ideal of a man for that time. He was God's man for God's work at God's chosen time. He was a chosen man for a chosen work at a chosen time. And yet you have to set alongside that the rather grim facts of David's actual life. You have to think of his moral lapses and his peccadilloes. You have to think of his calculating, callous mind in the matter of Uriah the Hittite. You have to think of his over-fondness for women and his love of ease and of luxury in later life. According to the narrative, David was a liar. He was an adulterer. He was a schemer, and he was a murderer. In fact, the word blood was just about the last word he uttered before he died. He was a man of blood. And yet, in Hebrews 11, he's described as a man of faith. How, therefore, can you set alongside the man of faith, the man after God's heart, this darker side in David's nature? Hebrews 11 says, by faith David conquered kingdoms, escaped the edge of the sword, and became mighty in war. And yet alongside all of that, you have this dark streak in his nature. Now, how can these two stand side by side in a man of faith? I want to do three things tonight, if my kist will hold out. First of all, I want us to look at David's family tree in the diagram I've prepared and see if we can learn from that something of what went to make the man. And then secondly, I want to look at two sets of pairs or contrasts that you find in David's life. And thirdly, I want to look at the triumphs of faith in his life. Turn then to this special sheet that I've printed and look at the family tree of David. You notice I started with Solomon, but of course we could go much back, much further than that, because Solomon was a man of the tribe of Judah. But we start with Solomon. And Solomon, of the tribe of Judah, married Rahab, the harlot of Jericho. And the word Rahab in Hebrew means the proud one, or the overweening one, or the one who goes too far. And that's the sort of lady he took to wife. Their son was called Boaz, which means a strength. And of course he fell in love with Ruth in that great romance in the Old Testament. And Ruth means a friend. And that must have been a marriage above all marriages. It's a pity there weren't more young people here tonight. The Bible, you know, teaches that God is a great romantic. He's got a great sense of romance. And when he engineers a marriage, it is a beautiful and a wonderful thing. So there you have strength, marrying friendship. And that's a nice guide for a right partnership in life. The strength of the man marrying the friendliness of the lady. Their son was Obed, which means a servant. Obadiah, the servant of Jehovah. Obed, a servant. And his son was Jesse, which means the outstanding one. And so there you have a most beautiful miniature of family life. Strength, marrying friendship. Out of that union comes service. Out of that union comes an outstanding man or a prominence. And out of Jesse there came seven sons and two daughters. And I've underlined the daughters to distinguish them from the boys, because it's difficult to separate them. Zeruiah was one of the girls, and Abigail was the other one. And the seven sons: Eliab, Abinadab, Shammah, Nathaniel, Radai, Ozem, David, who was the youngest of the family. You remember how Samuel came to Jesse's household to anoint the new king, and of course he started with Eliab, the oldest, and he looked into Eliab's face and said, "This is not the man. Have you another son?" So along comes Abinadab, and he works his way through the whole family of boys down to Ozem. And Samuel said, is this the last? Jesse said, "Well, there is another wee lad, but he's out on the hills looking after the sheep. He couldn't be the king. Send for him," said Samuel. So David came and was anointed by Samuel king, the youngest of the family. And so he got off to this great start that God raised him up from zero. He would have been a nonentity, the youngest boy in the family, and yet God lifted him up. Now, that's a great start to any heritage and any family tree. I think of how Thomas Nelson, the great publisher, was brought up in a button ben and went to Edinburgh, where he became Thomas Nelson, the great publishers. And when he had built up his printing empire and lived in this grand business block in Edinburgh, he took the stones of his mother's button ben and built them on the roof of his factory. And the button ben was there to remind him of the humbleness of his origins. However great and famous and rich he became, the button ben reminded him of where he came from. And David came from zero. He was the last in the line, but God lifted him up. And no sooner had he been lifted up than, of course, he fell into moral lapses, because the next line is the list of his wives. His first one was Michal, who was the daughter of Saul. Then there was Ahinoam, who bore him Amnon. Then there was Abigail, Maacah, who was the mother of Absalom, Haggith, who was the mother of Adonijah, Abital, Eglah, Bathsheba, the wife of Uriah the Hittite, who married David and became the mother of Solomon. And the Bible tells us there were others. And it also tells us there was a harem. And in fact, that scenario really set a lifetime of catastrophe for King David. If you look at Ahinoam, the second wife there, you notice that she was the mother of Amnon. Well, that is a very sordid story. Do you know it? Amnon fell in love with his sister, and he was demented with love for her. He was distracted by his desire for her. She was called Tamar, sister of Absalom. And in due season, he humiliated the girl. And the net result of that was that Amnon was murdered by his brother Absalom. Look at Maacah. Absalom was a teddy boy. He was very proud of his hair, you remember? So what else is new? Although it's gone out of fashion now, they go around nowadays looking like the last of the Mohicans, don't they? Sculpt. But Absalom had a massive shock of hair, and he was so vain that he used to have his hair cut off once a year and weighed in public just to let everybody see what a macho fellow he was. And he rebelled against his father because he wanted the throne. And as he fled from his father, you know the story, his hair was his undoing because it caught in a tree and he was hanged by his hair. His vanity was his undoing. And that was the end of Absalom. Look at Haggith. Her boy was called Adonijah. And Adonijah was also an ambitious young man. Haggith was a Bedouin woman. She was a wild lady from the desert. And Adonijah had some of the wildness in him and some of the cunning of the Arab Bedouin. Because one day he went to the stables and he mounted his father's mule. Now, the mule was the royal animal in ancient Israel. Behold, thy king cometh unto me, unto thee, riding on an ass. The ass, the donkey, the mule, these were the royal animals, not horses. And so when Adonijah rode about on the royal mule, everybody knew he was proclaiming himself king and ousting his father David from the throne. And Adonijah too came to grief. So there David lost three of his sons in tragic circumstances simply because of his unbridled love of women. And it was Solomon who outlasted them. But even Solomon was very far from perfect as a son, because the Bible tells us that although he asked for wisdom from God, Solomon was very sensuous and very decadent. And when Solomon died, his son Rehoboam was such a violent boy that his cruelty and his ambition divided the kingdom, and 10 tribes left the royal house of Judah to form the kingdom of Israel. And the moral of all that is that we reap what we sow in our families. And I think that it takes a great deal of Christian courage to face the fact that in our families, the grace and the judgments of God operate. If I may foist a personal interjection on you, I can look back over at least 4 generations of relatives, and I can see the triumphs of the gospel in some lives, and I can see the tragedies of sin and wasted lives in my family. And it takes courage to face grace and judgment in your family, just as it takes courage to face grace and judgment operating in nations. And if I may say so, grace and judgment operating in churches. Did you know that the future of this church lies in the hands of the present members? I know that it happens under God. I know that it happens under the sovereignty of God's throne. I know that what happens to churches happens underneath the shadow of God's throne. But men are not neutral. And what happens to this church depends upon the religious performance of the present members. Grace and judgment operates in churches and in nations and in families. And that is the message of David's family tree. But there's also a word of hope. Look at the middle section of this sheet. And there are 2 sets of pairs there. In fact, they really are sets of contrasts. The first is the contrast between the David, who was a man of war, with his son Solomon, who was a man of peace. Now, the Hebrew word shalom, from which Solomon comes, is the word peace. It's the same as the Arabic salam, which is peace. And you find it in the city of Jerusalem, Yerushalom, Yerushalam, the city of peace. And just as Solomon was a man of peace, so David was essentially a man of war. And his lifetime saw him involved in wars against the Philistines in the southwest of the country, and on the other side of the Jordan, the Moabites and the Ammonites, who were descended from Lot, the Edomites, who were descended from Esau, and away in the north, the Syrians. And so David was a man of blood, not only because he engineered the murder of Uriah the Hittite, but because the greater part of his life was spent fighting his enemies. And the contrast between these two men is the contrast between Christ's kingdom at war and Christ's kingdom at peace. And on the one side, as Christians, we're called to fight the fight of faith and called to be soldiers of Jesus Christ, dealing first of all with the enemies inside us, the personal sins, our personal failings, and our prevailing sins, and so on, dealing with the enemies inside us, and then dealing with the enemies outside us, the enemies of Christ in the world, the visible evidences in the world of the work of the evil one. Pornography and drugs and the demonic and the cults and the heresy in the churches. I was speaking to a friend last weekend who had been to a large conference of psychiatrists, and she heard some appalling papers on the relationship and the intimate links between pornography and drugs and the demonic in our world today, in Mexico and Guatemala and Bolivia, where hundreds of little children have just gone missing. And they've been picked off the streets by demon worshippers who are involved in the drug trade and in pornography. And remains have been found of those children in pots and in jars. They'd been used for the worship of demons. Pornography, drugs, and the demonic. We are called on to be the soldiers of Christ in that kind of world, the fight of faith. And alongside the fight of faith typified by David's kingdom, there is the victory of faith, which is typified by Solomon's kingdom, which was a kingdom at rest. There were no wars during the reign of Solomon. It was a kingdom of peace. And it is a type of what the New Testament calls abiding in Christ and resting in Christ. It is the peace of finding a perfect rest in the finished work of Jesus Christ. A kingdom at war and a kingdom at peace. And the important thing for us to see is this, that if you are in Christ, they both happen at the same time. Fighting for Christ and resting in Christ are concomitant. They go on at the same time. You fight the spiritual battles of the gospel inside you and outside you. And even while you fight the battles, at the same time, you are resting in the perfect victory of Jesus Christ. I've said it before, and I'll say it again. Every Christian soldier starts from victory. It's not a case of fighting and struggling towards victory. It's a case of starting from a finished work and from a finished victory and fighting for Christ on that ground. You see, in the battle of faith, the end is not in doubt and the issue is not in doubt. The important thing is to be a faithful soldier of the Lamb. If I may say so, that is all that I covet in my ministry. I do not covet success, which is just as well, because I don't think I'll ever be successful. I don't covet success. I don't covet importance. I don't covet fame. All that I covet in my ministry is to go on being a good soldier of the Lamb and a faithful soldier of Jesus Christ. The kingdom at war and the kingdom at peace go on side by side. The second set of contrasts is the contrast between David, the man of poverty, and David, the man of prosperity. And there's no question of this, that David was at his very best in his early years of hardship and struggle. It's when he was in the wilderness on the run from Saul, being hunted, as one commentator says, like a wild partridge on the hills of Judah. It was then that David was at his best as a man of poverty. But when he became a man of prosperity and thought he had arrived in his palace, he exposed himself to all that was weak and vulnerable in his personality. I remember hearing my brother James Philip preaching a great sermon on these words, which I have down here. At the time of year when kings go forth to battle, David tarried in Jerusalem. When he should have been fighting, he was lounging about on a rooftop, and his eyes wandered to a neighboring rooftop, and he saw Bathsheba. And that was the start of the episode of Uriah the Hittite. Do you know the really heinous thing in that story? Uriah was a pagan who had come to God. He was a Hittite. He was one of the last relics of the vast Hittite empire. Here was a man who used to say his prayers to heathen gods, but he had been attracted by Jehovah, by monotheism, and by the clean religion of Israel. And David murdered him. Now, that was worse than the adultery. It was worse than the adultery because it was calculated. He engineered it. He said, now put this man, Uriah, into the forefront of the battle. Shove him out. Push him forward. David was always at his best as a man of poverty. The Bible doesn't speak about the blessings of poverty. There are no real blessings in poverty as such. Go to the slums in Guatemala and you'll see. Go to the slums in Mexico City or Bolivia or the Argentine and you'll see that poverty degrades men and women and makes them subhuman. There are no blessings in poverty. But there are dangers in riches. And it was when David became prosperous that he fell. And lastly, the three triumphs of faith in David. First of all, David's faith evoked from him the virtues of mercy and compassion and of understanding. You can look up the story of Shimei for yourself in 2 Samuel 16. Shimei was the man who cursed David. And in that world, a curse was a real thing. But when David came to power, he spared him. Saul in the cave, his arch enemy. David spared him. Do you know the story? It's a story not without its sense of humor. In 1 Samuel 24, Saul had gone into the cave for the purposes of his toilet. Round the walls of the cave, David and his men were hiding. What an opportunity to catch your enemy just like that. But David spared him because real faith breeds mercy and compassion and understanding even for your enemies. 1 Samuel chapter 24. You may smile. 1 Samuel 24. You may smile. When Saul returned from following the Philistines, he was told, behold, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi. Then Saul took 3,000 chosen men out of all Israel and went to seek David and his men in front of the wild goats' rocks. And he came to the sheepfolds by the way where there was a cave, and Saul went in to relieve himself. Now David and his men were sitting in the innermost parts of the cave. What an opportunity. And the men of David said to him, "Here is the day of which the Lord said to you, 'Behold, I will give your enemy into your hand, and you shall do to him as it shall seem good to you.' Then David arose and stealthily cut off the skirt of Saul's robe. And afterward David's heart smote him because he'd cut off Saul's skirt. He said to his men, 'The Lord forbid that I should do this thing to my Lord, the Lord's anointed, to put forth my hand against him, seeing he is the Lord's anointed.' And so David persuaded his men with these words and did not permit them to attack Saul. And Saul rose up and left the cave and went upon his way. Afterward, David also arose and went out of the cave and called after Saul, 'My lord the king.' And when Saul looked behind him, David bowed with his face to the earth and did obeisance. David said to Saul, 'Why do you listen to the words of men who say, "Behold, David seeks your heart. Lo, this day your eyes have seen how the Lord gave you today into my hand in the cave, and some bade me kill you, but I spared you. I said, "I will not put forth my hand against the Lord, my Lord, for he is the Lord's anointed. See, my father, see the skirt of your robe in my hand. For by the fact that I cut off the skirt of your robe and did not kill you, you may know and see that there is no wrong or treason in my hands. I have not sinned against you, though you hunt my life to take it. May the Lord judge between me and you. May the Lord avenge me upon you, but my hand shall not be against you. As the proverb of the ancients says, out of the wicked comes forth wickedness, but my hand shall not be against you. After whom has the king of Israel come out? After whom do you pursue? After a dead dog? After a flea? May the Lord therefore be judge and give sentence between me and you, and see to it. Plead my cause and deliver me from your hand." When David had finished speaking these words to Saul, Saul said, "Is this your voice, my son David?" And Saul lifted up his voice and wept. He said to David, "You are more righteous than I, for you have repaid me good, whereas I have repaid you evil, and you have declared this day how you have dealt well with me, in that you did not kill me when the Lord put me into your hands. For if a man finds his enemy, will he let him go away safe? So may the Lord reward you with good for what you have done to me this day. And now, behold, I know that you shall surely be king, and that the kingdom of Israel shall be established in your hand." Real faith evokes mercy and compassion. And the story of Mephibosheth in 2 Samuel chapter 9 and verse 1. Mephibosheth was the son of Jonathan, Saul's son, and therefore was a threat to King David and to his kingdom. At any time, Mephibosheth could have risen up and challenged David's kingdom. But this is what happened. 2 Samuel chapter 9 and verse 1. David said, "Is there still anyone left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake. Now there was a servant of the house of Saul whose name was Ziba. They called him to David, and the king said to him, "Are you Ziba?" And he said, "Your servant is he." And the king said, "Is there not still someone of the house of Saul that I may show the kindness of God to him?" Ziba said to the king, "There is still a son of Jonathan. He is crippled in his feet." The king said to him, "Where is he?" Ziba said to the king, "He is in the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, at Lodabar." Then King David sent and brought him from the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, at Lodabar. And Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, son of Saul, came to David rather fearfully, fell on his face, and did obeisance. He thought he was going to be executed. David said, "Mephibosheth." And he answered, "Behold your servant." David said to him, "Do not fear. I will show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan, and I will restore to you all the land Saul your father, and you shall eat at my table always." A cripple boy. And he did obeisance and said, "What is your servant that you should look upon a dead dog such as I?" Then the king called Ziba, Saul's servant, and said to him, "All that belonged to Saul and to all his house I have given to your master's son. And you and your sons and your servants shall till the land for him and bring in the produce, that your master's son may have bread to eat. But Mephibosheth, your master's son, shall always eat at my table." Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. Then Ziba said to the king, "According to all that my lord the king commands his servant, so will your servant do." So Mephibosheth, this cripple boy, sat at David's table, ate at David's table like one of the king's sons. And Mephibosheth had a young son whose name was Micah. And all who dwelt in Ziba's house became Mephibosheth's servants. So Mephibosheth dwelt in Jerusalem, for he ate always at the king's table, and he was lame in both his feet. Mercy and compassion for your enemies. Mercy and compassion for those who are a threat to you. And mercy and compassion for a handicapped boy. That's what faith did in David. Secondly, faith lifted David into the battle behind the battles and the news behind the news, which is the spiritual conflict between light and darkness. The references there are to Saul's attempt to transfix David with a spear and to kill him. And that attempt of Saul on the life of David is a tiny part of what in the Old Testament is known as attacks on the seed royal. Right through the Old Testament, starting with Cain's murder of Abel, you have the attacks of Satan on the royal line that one day was to emerge in Jesus the Christ. Cain murders Abel. It's an attack on the seed royal. Saul tries to murder David. The great wicked queen Athaliah exterminates the royal house of Judah in the book of Kings, trying to kill them off. But a nurse saved a baby. And from that baby came the Christ. Josiah was killed by Pharaoh Necho at Megiddo, an attack on the royal seed. Herod murders the babies in Bethlehem, the massacre of the innocents, an attack on the seed royal. Anybody who has faith in Christ is lifted above the conflicts of this world into that dimension of spiritual warfare. And lastly, because the time has gone, faith drew out the Lord's love for David and David's love for the Lord. And it's characterized by this great phrase which you find in the Psalms. My heart is fixed. In Psalm 57, for example, in closing, not to weary you with quotations, Psalm 57 and at verse 7, and always when he says it, his heart breaks into song. Psalm 57 and 7, my heart is fixed, O God, my heart is fixed. I will sing and make melody, awake my soul, awake, O harp and lyre, I will awake the dawn. I'll wake in the morning, I'll bring in a new day with my singing. I will awake the dawn. I will give thanks to thee, O Lord, among the peoples. I will sing praises to thee among the nations. For thy steadfast love is great to the heavens, thy faithfulness to the clouds. My heart is fixed, O God. And lastly, in Psalm 108, very nearly the same words. Psalm 108 and the first verse. Have we run out of tape? Well, it's not surprising, really, is it? Psalm 108, verse 1. My heart is fixed, O God. My heart is fixed. I will sing and make melody. Awake my soul. Same words. Awake, O harp and lyre. I will awake the dawn. I'll bring in a new day with my singing. I will give thanks to thee, O Lord, among the peoples. I will sing praises to thee among the nations.